I'll read the essay In Endless Song, which will appear in a new book called We All Live in the Big Volcano, Catastrophe and Renewal on Mount St. Helens. Number 1, Ghost Lake. Ghost Lake Trail forges through the blast zone where the forest took the full force of the Mount St. Helens eruption. Spruce and fir lie where they fell, as if an army of trees, fleeing, had pitched on their faces in the direction of their flight. The blast rolled over them, scorched their limbs, crackled their skin, pressed them into the ash. Ranks on ranks of shattered tree trunks, half buried in stones, reach out with broken limbs. The blast must have flanked the mountain and charged down the hillside, burning the slope to bedrock. Then the ground fell out from under the trees, dropping them in a slag heap of pumice and slash. This is where we're hiking, my friends and I, across this gray and ruined land toward a pond pierced by snags. My friends are singing. They astonish me. They laugh as they sing, dredging their memories for the words to an old hymn. Through all the tumult and the strife, I hear the music ringing. There is the wandering coyote, kicking up dust as it licks for ants and defecates a twist of ash. There are the facts of spider silk tingling in green moss and blanketing lichen and beavers trooping down new river courses to chew willows nourished by elk born in ash and dust. There must be a lesson here, too, and is it this? That no matter how fragile and finite small lives may be, no matter how we grieve foresight of our own deaths, life itself is a powerful force that will not be turned away. But how can we take comfort in that, we mortals who cling to the significance of small lives? Part 2, Horse Ridge. We've pitched our tents in pumice on a north-south spine. Snow-crowned Mount Adams floats on forest to the east. To the west, Mount St. Helens stands raw and gray. As daylight drains off our camp, pink light collects in the cracked bowl of the volcano. One by one, we set down our coffee cups and gather on the ridge to watch. The pink cloud glows above lavender cliffs and dims the rosy distance. At a sudden rumble of rock, we shout and scramble for binoculars to watch rubble roll down the caldera's flank. A dust plume boils up, bursts red, and pulses over the rim. The last of the light shafts through broken rock, flickering in the smoke. I've seen paintings of creation that look like this, a red gleam moving over smoking stone. And I've seen imaginings of the end of time that look just the same, gray rock seamed with fire, rising smoke, falling darkness, nothing left of life, except a handful of human beings lined up at the edge of destruction, unable to speak. The smoke stays with me in my dreams. In the dark, before morning, low rumbling shakes me awake, light strobes the side of the tent. An eruption? I'm on my knees at the door, but it's lightning that crashes between the mountains. Thunder rolls again, and I unzip the tent. The broken side of the mountain, that shattered tooth, fills the doorway. A bolt of lightning shoots from the crater almost to the moon, half hidden behind glowing clouds. The tent fills with light. Thunder shakes the ground under my knees. Should I run down the road to the landing and bring up a van to protect us, all the beautiful pyroclastic minds of my friends? 1, 2, 3. I count the seconds to gauge the distance of the storm and turn my head to judge its direction. Making camp on the highest ridge for miles around had seemed like such a good idea. The lightning might pass to the north. It might not. In the morning, I pull on a rain slicker and climb out into a cold, wet day. Dawn floods under purple clouds that dash lightning onto the mountains to the north. Wind-driven rain rivers down the road. But sunshine pours over clouds on Mount Adams, and when we gather for breakfast, a meadowlark sings. Under the flapping tarp that shelters the picnic tables, a geologist is hanging onto the tent poles to keep the whole structure from winging across the valley. With his free hand, he gestures toward the crater. Lightning creates the conditions for life, he says. The gas cloud over the 1980 eruption was full of lightning, up, down, every which way. The lightning charged the nitrogen in the ammonia and ozone. So when the ash finally fell from the cloud, it was full of the nitrogen that would fertilize new plants. Here on the volcano, I no longer understand the difference between destruction and creation. The scientists among us can hardly contain their excitement at the ecological possibilities of the eruption, what they call this great biomass disturbance event. Disturbance kicks the world into motion. What had been stagnant, the mature stands of fir and pine, is booted into new life. What had been simple is now complex. What had been monochrome is now a hillside of purple lupin and orange butterflies. What had been silent now chatters and sings. Destruction, creation, catastrophe, renewal, sorrow, joy, these are human projections onto the landscape, the ecologists say. What is real, they say, is change. What is necessary, they say, is change. Suddenly there are new niches, new places to grow and flourish, ponds, landslides, rocky hillsides, a great profusion of edges where beetles troop over stumps, huckleberries emerge from snowbanks, astonished pocket gophers dig into the sun. Meadowlarks, an ecologist exults, sweeping his arm toward the expanse of lupins and corn lilies under the storm. Where else can you find meadowlarks on a mountaintop? This biomass disturbance has made a new place for birdsong. I understand that. But at what terrible cost to nestlings burned in their nests, the sudden silence where there had been hungry peeping? Lord knows, I'd like to see the world the way ecologists do. If all of us thought of death as change rather than catastrophe, could we blunt Earth's edge of sorrow? And isn't this a source of hope, that the forces of nature turn death into life again and again unceasing? Again I heard them hymn. Above Earth's lamentation, I hear the sweet, though far-off hymn that hails a new creation. But sometimes I can't hear the hymn for the crying of small birds in the back of my mind. Part 3. The Trail from Donnybrook. Climbing the trail from Donnybrook, I take small steps across a landscape of falling, this mountain in the process of falling down. It scares me to walk the trail, one jogging shoe on a rock that must only yesterday have fallen from the mountain, the other on a slope of pumice that trickles down the hill. If I slip, there's nothing that will hold me. The little flower, called pearly everlasting, clings to the rubble by what roots, by what hope against reason? And how can it deserve this name, everlasting, with one root in dribbling rubble, the under a new falling snow? Putting one foot in front of the other across this scratch in the cliff, I lift my hand to block the view of the distance below me to Spirit Lake. The lake lies as still as the silence after a car wreck, that still, except for floating tree trunks bare and gray. They slowly rotate in the wind that curls around the cliff. How do we walk these skidding paths across the edge of an earth that's tumbling around us? I can hear it go, the clink of cobbles down the face of rough stone. Every step spills sand and stone and bends fireweed to the ground. I thought I would learn peace from the mountain, acceptance. I thought I would find comfort in the tenacity of life precariously rooted in constant change. I thought I would learn grace, which is only this, balance as the world slides away under my feet. Instead, I learned how different I am from a mountain which is not afraid to fall. Tumbling rocks shake me body and soul, cascading down, leaping over rim rock, filling the valleys. The stream of pebbles shakes the belief that human lives are the measure of time. They undercut the conceit that humans are the center of creation, our hopes and sorrows a special concern of the earth's. And what do they say about human pride? The confidence that global events are under human control, that we might understand and dominate the earth. Ha! The mountain laughs. Ha! A great explosion of ash and steam jolted by lightning. But then there is this. Would we fear loss so desperately if we didn't have such a love for the earth and its life, for our own lives in the midst of indifferent laughter? Would we be afraid of the silence of a robin if a robin's song didn't mean so much to us? Would we be so afraid of our own deaths if we didn't love life so urgently? Maybe fear of losing it all can lead us to a place of rejoicing, a recognition of how deeply we value the living, changing world, how lovingly we cling to our place in it. How should a person live in a world that erupts catastrophically, sliding down and down? On the flank of this big volcano we call Earth, how should a person live? I don't know for sure, but this, at least, is important, especially when I'm afraid to be open to wonder. Especially when I'm grieving, to be amazed by beauty, to rejoice at the inevitability of change and the urgency of life, the power of the earth that flows out from its center and gathers all life back into its fold. and especially when I'm caught up in my human-scaled sense of time and significance, to remember that my life is part of the endless flow of fiery rock, to be astonished and grateful. My life flows on in endless song, the hymn says. How can I keep from singing?